Speechware Document 36. Child Labor and Employer's Liability. From an address delivered in the Georgia State Building, at the Jamestown Exposition, June 1, 1907. In the fundamentals I have found American citizens to be just about the same everywhere. In whatever locality of the country we live, whatever our fortune or occupation in life, there exist just about the same essential good qualities and much the same shortcomings in any gathering on our citizens. Of course, each community has its special temptations, its special shortcomings, and if it is wise, each community will try to cure itself rather than to cause heartburnings by railing at the shortcomings of a sister community. There is ample field for the reform energies of every one of us in his or her particular sphere of home and neighborhood activity. Not only is all of this true as between one community and another, but it is just as true between one class of our citizens and another. Now and then we meet well-meaning people who have a genuine horror and dread of all rich men and think of them as being set apart by peculiar vice and iniquity. Now and then we meet equally well-meaning rich men who have an equally irrational dread of those whom they style labor leaders. In each case I think the hostility is in large part due to a want of sympathy caused by complete ignorance of the men who arouse such distrust or anger. As a matter of fact, if we take a given number of men of large fortune and a like number of wage workers, we find that in their essential human nature they are all alike. In each group we find men, as wise and as foolish, as good and as bad as in the other group. Such being the case, it is certainly well that, so far as possible, when the men of a given group, as a whole, act in a way that we deem contrary to the public interest, we should treat the action as a wrong to be remedied rather than as a wrong to be avenged. We ought not to tolerate wrong. It is a sign of weakness to do so, and in its ultimate effects weakness is often quite as bad as wickedness. But in putting a stop to the wrong we should, so far as possible, avoid getting into an attitude of vindictive hatred toward the wrongdoer. He may be morally to blame and it may be necessary to punish him, but, in the other hand, the wrong he has committed may simply be due to the existing condition of things, to conditions under which he has been brought up, and in such a case, while we must apply the remedy, and see that there is no further chance of harm to the community, it is neither just nor far-sighted to exact revenge for what has been done. In short, friends, let us realize that in very truth we are knit together in ties of brotherhood, and that, while it is proper and necessary that we should insist upon our rights, we should yet be patient and considerate in bearing with one another, and in trying, so far as in us lies, each to look at the problems that face us from his brother's standpoint as well as his own. During the last quarter of a century this nation has made astounding strides in material progress, and in no other section has this progress been more noteworthy than in the South. While her agriculture has grown faster than ever before, there has also been a new growth of her manufacturing industries. Indeed, there has been growth of every kind. But of course there is ample room for further growth. The South will be all the better for new immigrants of the right type, and I hope to see steamship lines carrying such immigrants established at ports like Savannah and Charleston, just as I hope to see ports like New Orleans connected by lines of pound steamers with the South American continent, the continent with which our relations should grow ever closer and mutually more advantageous. In the South, as everywhere through the Union, we need to see a good education given free to all children, no matter what may be their race or color. Nor can we wisely permit this education to be of a merely literary type. More and more we are growing to realize that there must be an education of the hand as well as of the head. There must be agricultural and industrial colleges, and, above all, schools in which there can be elementary preparation for agriculture and industry. These schools for technical training will hold a great place in the future in fitting our citizens for doing their economic duties in the best possible shape. In the South there is a population peculiarly fitted to profit by them, a population which has been generally referred to as poor white, a population of splendid capacities, and almost purely of the old native stock, which simply lacks the opportunity to develop a degree of industrial efficiency unsurpassed elsewhere on this continent. It is a matter for congratulation that there is such a steady increase of interest in the southern states in everything pertaining to children. This has already markedly shown itself, and I hope will still more markedly show itself in the future, in warring against the evil of child labor in factories. The factory is a very poor place indeed for a child. Indeed, personally I think the factory a poor place for a woman, certainly for a married woman, or for an unmarried woman for more than a very few years. In any community organized in really healthy lines, the average woman will have quite enough to do in her own home, whether she is rich or poor, and nowhere else can she do work of such value to the nation as a whole, and by work, I mean her housework, her work, as housewife and mother, and not so-called home industries. As regards children, it is as essential to look after their physical as their mental training. We cannot afford to let children grow up ignorant, and if they are sent to school they cannot, while young, also work hard outside without detriment, physical, mental and moral. There is urgent need for the health authorities to increase their care over the hygienic conditions and surroundings of children of tender years, and especially to supervise those in the schools. It is a good thing to try to reform bad children, to try to build up degenerate children, but it is an even better thing to try to keep healthy in soul, body, and mind those children who are now sound, but who may easily grow up unsound, if no care is taken of them. The nation's most valuable asset is the children, for the children are the nation of the future. All people alive to the nation's needs should join together to work for the moral, spiritual, and physical welfare of the children in all parts of our land. I am glad that there has been founded a National Society of Public School Hygiene, and I wish it, and all its branches, well in every way. There is increasing need that the welfare of the children should be effectively safeguarded by governmental action, with the proviso, however, that this action shall be taken with knowledge and in a spirit of robust common sense, for philanthropy, whether governmental or individual, is a curse and not a blessing when marked by a spirit of foolish sentimentality and ignorance. Such governmental action is merely one inevitable result of the ever-increasing growth of our complex industrialism. Decade by decade, it becomes more and more necessary that, without sacrificing their individual independence, the people of this country shall recognize in more effective form their mutual interdependence, and the duty of safeguarding the interest of each in the ultimate interest of all. We have inherited and developed a superbly self-reliant individualism in this country. I most earnestly hope that it will not be lost, that it will never be exchanged for a deadening socialism. The only permanently beneficial way in which to help anyone is to help him to help himself, if either private charity, or governmental action, or any form of social expression destroys the individual's power of self-help, the gravest possible wrong is really done to the individual. Nevertheless, as the conditions of life grow more complex, it is not possible to trust our welfare only to the unbridled individual initiative of each unit of our population working, as that unit wills. We need laws for the care of our children which were not needed when this country was in its infancy. We need laws for the control of vast corporations such as were not needed, when the individual fortunes were far smaller than at present, and when these fortunes were not combined for business use. In the same way we need to change our attitude toward labor problems from what that attitude was in the days when the great bulk of our people lived in the country with no more complex labor relations than is implied in the connection between the farmer and the hired help. For example, the great increase in mechanical and manufacturing operations means a corresponding increase in the number of accidents to the wage workers employed therein, these including both preventable and inevitable accidents. To the ordinary wage worker's family, such a calamity means grim hardship. As the work is done for the employer, and therefore ultimately for the public, it is a bitter injustice that it should be the wage worker himself and his wife and children who bear the whole penalty. Legislation should be had, alike from the nation and from the states, not only to guard against the needless multiplication of these accidents, but to relieve the financial suffering due to them. Last winter, Congress passed a safety appliance law which marked a long stride in the right direction. But there should be additional legislation to secure pecuniary compensation to workmen suffering from accidents, and when they are killed, to their families. At present, both in the sphere covered by national legislation, and in the sphere covered by state legislation, the law in too many cases leaves the financial burden of industrial accidents to be borne by the injured workmen and their families, and a workman who suffers from an accident either has no case at all for redress or else must undertake a suit for damages against his employer. The present practice is based on the view announced nearly 70 years ago that principles of justice and good sense demand that a workman shall take upon himself all the ordinary risks of his occupation. In my view, principles of justice and good sense demand the very reverse of this view, which experience has proved to be unsound and productive of widespread suffering. It is neither just, expedient, nor humane. It is revolting to judgment and sentiment alike that the financial burden of accidents occurring because of the necessary exigencies of their daily occupations should be thrust upon those sufferers who are least able to bear it, and that such remedy, as is theirs, should only be obtained by litigation which now burdens our courts. As a matter of fact, there is no sound economic reason for distinction between accidents caused by negligence and those which are unavoidable, and the law should be such that the payment of those accidents will become automatic instead of being a matter for a lawsuit. Workmen should receive a certain definite and limited compensation for all accidents in industry, irrespective of negligence. When the employer, the agent of the public, in his own responsibility and for his own profit, in the business of serving the public, starts in motion agencies which create risks for others, he should take all the ordinary and extraordinary risks involved, and though the burden will at the moment be his, it will ultimately be assumed, as it ought to be, by the general public. Only in this way can the shock of the accident be diffused, for it will be transferred from employer to consumer, for whose benefit all industries are carried in. From every standpoint, the change would be a benefit. The community at large should share the burden as well as the benefits of industry. Employers would thereby gain a desirable certainty of obligation and get rid of litigation to determine it. The workman and the workman's family would be relieved from a crushing load. The national government should be a model employer. It should demand the highest quality of service from its employees and should care for them properly in return. Congress should adopt legislation providing limited but definite compensation for accidents to all workmen within the scope of the federal power, including employees in Navy yards and arsenals. Similar legislation should follow throughout the states. The old and inadequate remedy of suit for negligence would then gradually disappear. Such a policy would mean that with increased responsibility of the employer would come increased care, and accidents would be reduced in number. The temporary burden involved will not hamper our industries. Long experience of compensation laws in other countries has demonstrated their benefit. What we advocate is only a simple measure of justice, only one step toward the goal of securing, so far as human wisdom can secure, fair and equitable treatment for each and every one of our people. As a corollary to the above, let me point out the extreme unwisdom of the railway companies in fighting the constitutionality of the National Employers Liability Law. No law is more emphatically needed, and it must be kept on the statute books in drastic and thoroughgoing form. The railroads are prompt to demand the interference and to claim the protection of the federal courts in times of riot and disorder, and in turn the federal government should see to it that they are not permitted successfully to plead that they are under the federal law when thereby their own rights can be protected, but outside of it, when it is invoked against them in behalf of the rights of others. If it is proper for the federal courts to issue injunctions in behalf of railroads, it is proper that railroads should be held to a strict liability for accidents occurring to their employees. There should be the plainest and most unequivocal additional statement by enactment of Congress, to the effect that railroad employees are entitled to receive damages for any accident that comes to them as an incident of the performance of their duties, and the law should be such that it will be impossible for the railroad successfully to fight it without thereby forfeiting all right to the protection of the federal government under any circumstances. In the same way, there should be rigid federal legislation to minimize all railway accidents.